Talk 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to Laura Fox for getting us to the end of the week. It's Friday the 4th of March and this is Game On. Coming up today, shock as cricket icon Shane Warne dies at just 52.
One of my strengths on the field is I can intimidate people. Whether it be a word, whether it's to stand at the top mark and spin the ball, whether it's to eyeball someone at the batsman at the other end, whether it was a little sledge here or there, whatever it was, I was a man on a mission. I wasn't taking any prisoners. I wouldn't have liked to play against me. I was nasty.
In rugby, the IRFU says sorry as an independent report lays a new foundation for our women's national team.
I guess what I can say for certain is that there's the total commitment of the IRFU to the women's game. The culture that was referred to in the player's letter, I'd like to believe that they have more confidence in that now. It'll probably take some more time, I guess, but I can assure you of the total commitment of not just myself, but of the union committee to the women's game, and they are fully behind everything we're doing.
We will also have a Manchester derby to talk about and much more with Alan Cawley. Jane Mangan will chat to us about racing. And if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. We are going to talk about Shane Warne. I think the whole sporting world was shocked today when the news broke that Shane had passed away. One of the finest bowlers of all time. He revived the art of leg spin and was just 52 when he passed away a little bit earlier from a suspected heart attack. Alan Lewis, a former Ireland cricketer, joins us now on the line. We're also joined by Jura Siggins cricket writer. Alan Cawley is with me in studio. Alan Lewis, I'm going to go to you first, a long-time cricket watcher, fan, expert. How special was Shane Warne?
Oh, he was extraordinary, really. He was the best way to describe him in a sense, in every way, was the George Best of cricket. He actually started quite poorly in his test career. He went for over 150, 160 in his first game. Five games later, he was part of an unlikely win in Sri Lanka, and then in 1993, bowled that wonder ball that probably elevated him to a stage, and then went on to 708 test wickets. An amazing, stellar career. It wasn't without controversy, which I suppose all geniuses tend to be, and he was one of those, because growing up, there was Abdul Qadir, who we kind of marveled at, and then, you know, Shane Warne came along, and now realistically, there's wrist spinners of incredible quality nearly in every team that plays cricket at the moment.
Jura Siggins is also with us on the line. Jura, often when we have these spectacular players with huge characters and presence, they don't have careers that justify the talent that they have. Often they get derailed along the way, but he just really had it all.
He did, and I'd almost argue with Alan there. He was describing him as the George Best of cricket. I mean, I don't think George Best's achieved as much at all as Shane Warne achieved in cricket. I mean, he was a fantastic cricketer. He smashed most of the records that there were to be smashed. Changed the game as well. He literally did change the game. And he was like almost like a rock star, I suspect. You could say he had, you know, he had the hair, he had the ear stud, he had the many, many faults in terms of, you know, he was a bit of a poker player. He loved playing a bit of golf and got involved with inadvisable relationships, I suppose, failed drugs tests, gambling. But besides all that, when he got out onto the field, he just was magnificent and did it in a way that made him so attractive as a player, made him a very box office. He brought people into the grounds to watch him.
Sounds very like George Best that year.
Except I don't think Best would have achieved nearly as much George as Warne, though.
Yeah, no. Well, George Best played for Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
that's a slight difference in terms of international. But incredible, like as Jerry said. Listen, I'm just having a bit of a yarn with Jerry. There, we always have those over a pint or two. But he was an incredible. He was an absolutely incredible sportsman.
Yeah, and he transcends the sport of cricket as well. Like, you know, in every sport you'll have one or two people that, even when somebody might not be interested in a certain sport or any sport at all, they will know who they are. Alan Cawley is with me here in studio. Alan, Shane Warne was one of them for sure. Like, even WhatsApps that I'm on with people that aren't interested in sport at all, everybody is talking about it today.
Yeah, I think Ger's description of him being a bit of a rock star, that's exactly what he was, Marie. He was one of those kind of rare talents that when he played the specific sport that he specialised in, you couldn't take your eyes off him. And even when he wasn't bowling, he was always involved in the game, the bit of trash talk and whatever went on. And I only watched the documentary, funny enough, last week that's on Amazon. I'm a big cricket fan, so, and I love my sports documentaries, but the one with Warren, I couldn't wait to see it and watched it last week. And it's very rare that you hear news that stops you in your tracks. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe this news today, Marie. I really couldn't. And obviously, there's plenty going on in the world, which is we're in despair at the moment. But when I heard this news today, I couldn't believe it. And it was so, so sad, because he almost, when he did play, he almost felt as though he was always going to be the star of the match winner, almost indestructible. And to think at 52 years of age, he's gone so young, so much of his life left. Even after his brilliant career that he had, you listen to him on Sky on the punditry and all, speak so well on the game, so insightful as well. And he has that charisma that he brought off the pitch, obviously into that career as well. So it's desperately, desperately sad.
Yeah, he definitely brought a huge amount of eyeballs to the sport as well. And often when people are doing documentaries about their lives, they can be reluctant because they don't want the spotlight shone on them. But I think an awful lot of people will have tuned into Amazon today to watch that documentary, because it really was an excellent production, and just there was so much of him present and so much of people who had played with him and fans of him and rock stars themselves were in it as well. But let's hear a little bit from it.
I never really wanted to play cricket. I love cricket, but I'm AFL through and through. I love the physicality of it. I just love the sport. So when I got picked up for St Kilda Football Club, I'm like, wow, I'm not far off the big time. A letter comes in the post. Thank you for your time at the club. Your services are no longer required.
And that hurt. It really hurt.
When I got the flick in 88, I thought, well, maybe I'll play tennis instead of cricket. I was winning a couple of tournaments playing tennis, and suddenly I thought, well, maybe I should play tennis. It was pretty hard to have passion about anything. Well, spin bowling, I grew up at a cricket club called the East Sandringham Boys Cricket Club. It's a fantastic cricket club. It's just a great club. And luckily, I had a natural ability to spin the ball a long way. From memory, I think I was six, maybe seven, around. I was young, really young. And I think I was going through those concrete cylinder things in kindergarten, and someone jumped on my back and I ended up breaking both my legs. So my dad made me a trolley, and I had plaster to my ankles, and I had to use my hands to get around for a good 6 months, even longer. I have got quite big hands and big wrists, so I think it did help me to get around and strengthen those wrists at a young age, because leg spin bowling, you do use your wrists and everything. So I do think that played a big part.
That Shane Warne documentary is on Amazon Prime and so worth checking out. Ger, just listening to him talking there, and first of all, the fact that he wasn't interested in being a cricket player for quite a while. He wanted to be an AFL footballer, and that didn't work out then. It was cricket's gain, really.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was a fantastic sportsman in lots of ways. He had a hole in one at Augusta when he turned his hand to golf, and I think he got into the very last stages of a world poker tournament. I mean, he was a bit of one of these very rare people that comes around every century that can do almost anything they turn their hand to.
I like as well about him, Alan, that, you know, he's not afraid to admit the type of player that he was, you know, that he did do the odd bit of a sledge, he said, and, he's happy to intimidate people. He described himself as a player that he would have hated to play against because he was a little bit nasty, he said.
Yeah, well, that Australian team, you grew up playing in Australia. That was part of the culture. That's the way they played. They played aggressively the whole time. And, you know, when you're a sledger, you've got to be pretty good at it. And he was very good at it. And in terms of intimidatory stuff, and because he was so good, he did literally do that. And I remember watching, I think it was a T20 game in England where he had the microphone on. And he literally talked himself through a spell where he brought Hampshire to winning a game from a winning position. But it was just, he commentated his way through five overs that he bowled. I think he got 6 for 13 or something, nearly won the game. It was ridiculous. And that's just the way he was. And again, I think the other set of things is he was probably, and it's only when you listen to the punditry that was talked about by Alan there earlier, he was a fantastic tactician. He's brilliant to listen to as a pundit because he says it as it is and he's tactically so strong. And it was probably more because of his off-field activity that he never captained Australia, and he should have really captained Australia and never did. And again, when he did, even for the first time before the IPL, he went to the Rajasthan Royals, captained them to victory. I think in either certainly the first or the second of that particular tournament. But just a special type of person, and just as you say, box office. He was one of those cricketers you just always wanted to be in the ground watching him doing his trade.
One thing as well that stuck out, Marie, in the documentary, and obviously all these brilliant geniuses, as we describe, have the amazing talent, but he had that competitive streak as well. And he speaks about his brother growing up and that it was a win at all costs, no matter what they were doing, what game it was when they were playing. His parents as well speak a lot in the documentary, and they literally say it was win at all costs. And you need that to reach the very top. Obviously, you need amazing amounts of talent to achieve what he achieved, but you certainly need that nasty streak, that mean streak, that competitive edge. And I think that's what separated him from the rest. Even though he was a fun-loving character, he seemed, when it got on the pitch, it was business.
Yeah, he went and got that job done. Ger, from all the times that you saw him, do you have a standout moment or a special memory?
The only ball that everybody will remember Glenn won for was the first ball he ever got to bowl in a test match in England. That was a ridiculous ball. I mean, it'll be on television, it'll be on YouTube.
It's in the documentary as well.
Yeah. It's in the documentary.
And Mike Gatting talks about it.
Yeah, he got the ball to turn about 2.5 feet and took Mike Gatting's bail off. Gatting didn't know what had happened. Actually, there's a fantastic song being written about it by the Duckworth Lewis method. Neil Annan and his friend Tom Walsh wrote a song about it, the Irish guys, called Jiggery Pokery, just about that ball. And it's fantastic. You should listen to that too.
I think Balaki Clerkin of the Times tweeted it out a little bit earlier. It's definitely worth checking out. And Alan, just from your point of view, okay, that first ball in the Ashes, was there anything else that when you think of him that you go to that moment?
Well, like obviously that was the start of it, and then like you don't take the number of wickets that he took. And again, we were exposed to it the whole time, those Ashes series. Ironically, the funny one, the one that England won in 2005, where even, you know, the whole cricketing and non-cricketing public were absorbed in this particular series, but he famously dropped Kevin Peterson at first slip, and he was a very, very good catcher. You know, whatever way the light was at the oval, he dropped the catch, and England went on to win the test match. But he was just extraordinary in so many ways. And the other thing, he was kind of maverick as well. He had no time, like John Buchanan was the coach of Australia. It was fairly public rant that he had no time for him. He felt that, you know, cricket teams, and it's quite amazing in a sense in the world that you nearly have, you know, coaches to clip your nails now before you go and play cricket. There's nearly a coach for every player between. He had no time for that. His issue was that the team will decide what they're going to do. The captain was in charge, and off we go. Let's go out and play. And the types of things that he spoke about, I haven't watched. I can't wait. Well, terrible in the aftermath of a 52-year-old dying that you want to watch the documentary, but you know, it is extraordinary the way, and so much of what he talked about I agreed with, because I think there's a lot of nonsense that goes with those sorts of things, because you learn so much from your own experiences. And that's clearly, you know, for someone who had no real interest in cricket growing up, AFL and tennis, you know, that he just suddenly took to this thing and duck to water.
Yeah, and changed it as well. Okay, Alan and Jerry, thank you so much for joining us and for chatting through the life of Shane Warne there. He's packed so much into it in 52 years, and it's actually quite interesting, Alan Coy, standing here and talking about it. And, you know, because there were so many highlights and he touched an awful lot of people just from his presence, it's really sad, but there's a lot of highs from it as well.
Yeah, he certainly lived a life, that's for sure, Marie, even though, as I say, for one so young, he has packed in an awful lot, but it can't take you away from the thought of just how sad this is. Like, you know, it really is. Even though he's achieved a lot, he's done a lot, I'm sure there was more for him to do. Like a 52, if he was to be asked the question, I'm sure there was plenty ahead of him. And sadly, all that's been taken away. And obviously, there was news overnight of a former cricketer as well, Australian legendary figure as well. And ironically enough, his last tweet was about that. So it's crazy how things pan out, Marie. But at 52, like, for all he achieved, and the documentary is absolutely brilliant. Rod Marsh, yeah, I was that cricketer, but it's just, for all that he achieved, it's just so, so sad that he had a life basically ahead of him as well. And even in the documentary, he speaks about, and he was really honest, brutally honest. And again, it brings me back to get to that elite level that he got to in all sports. They have to make so many sacrifices, and he sacrificed the growing up of his kids, basically. And his kids were interviewed in it, and mm-hmm. they accepted that, look, Dad wasn't around because he was off doing his thing, travelling around the world with the cricket team. I think it was his first wife, she accepted that as well. She spoke really highly of him as well as a dad. And he was trying to make up for all those times. Not make up for them, but just the fact that he wanted to spend more time with his kids now. And he spoke so honestly about that. And for to have all that taken away from him, it's desperately sad. It really is. I can't believe the news. I love cricket and I loved Warren. I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's one of those ones. I think we're always going to remember where you are when you heard the news that Shane Warne had passed away, and everybody's thoughts are with all those that he's left behind.
RTE
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Now, welcome back. We are going to turn our attention to rugby. The much anticipated IRFU rugby review. Well, some of it was released today. The findings of the report into the failure of the women's team to qualify for the World Cup was presented today, with 30 recommendations and a promise of an additional €1 million for the women's game. To talk us through what is included in the report, I'm delighted to say that Cian Tracy of the Irish Independent is with us now. Cian, first of all, how are things?
Good, Marie, how are you?
Thank you very much for joining us. So look, we were waiting and waiting for this report for quite a while, and we didn't get the whole lot of it. It wasn't released in its entirety, but there were some recommendations that came as part of it. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in it?
Yeah, so I think there's probably been murmurings for the last couple of weeks that the report wasn't going to be released in full. The IRFU and kind of the independent people who were overseeing the review cited that it would potentially be a breach of confidentiality for the people who had agreed to partake in it. I would say the IRFU are probably regretting having said that they would publish their report in full. It would have been fairly damaging for people who had to read it in the public sphere as well. And you know, it probably opens a can of worms then for, you know, if the men were to fail at a World Cup, why wouldn't they release that in full as well? So there was plenty in it. Like you said, the 1 million further investment is hugely welcome. But I think what's more important in this is probably what extends beyond the financial kind of implications for it. You touched on the 30 recommendations that were made. I think the biggest takeaway for me was that within those recommendations, there was nothing in it that, as far as I could see, that would really stop you in your tracks and go, that's unreasonable. You're talking about stuff like preparation, facilities, video analysis, nutrition, training, coaching, leadership, all these kind of buzzwords that you would imagine are fairly standard practice in any high-performance unit. So to me, it was probably a damning indictment on what has been going on for the last few years if the independent review found that what I would perceive to be pretty basic requirements of, like I said, a high-performance unit. So that was the biggest sort of, I think, takeaway for me. I think it's encouraging that the IRFU are going to are introducing two new roles within the women's setup. So Gemma Crowley is going to be the new women's manager. She's vastly experienced. She's worked with the new head coach, Greg McWilliams, before. She's worked on Lions tours. She's worked at the World Cup. So I think that's hugely encouraging. Interestingly, they're not going to replace Anthony Eddy, who is, you know, his timing of stepping down from his role as director of women's rugby and sevens was interesting, to say the least, on the eve of yesterday, basically on the eve of when this was all going to come out. Instead of replacing him directly, the RFU are going to introduce a new role, basically, which is titled Head of Women's Performance and Pathways, which we can probably get into, like, what that means and why will it be different to what Anthony Eddy was doing. And I think the removal of the word sevens from that new role is probably telling, because there's been a lot of friction, Marie, as you well know yourself, over the last few years about sevens players and 15s players kind of jumping from one code to the other, because there are sevens contracts available for certain players within the setups, but obviously there's no 15s contracts, which is another matter altogether. And you know, the Women's Six Nations is going to start now in a few weeks when the men's is over, and this could potentially become an issue again, because we see it happening every year, because there is a sevens event on towards the end of the Six Nations. So there was a lot to get your head around. If you would be hoping that it is the start of a turning point for Irish women's rugby, but I don't think anyone is getting ahead of themselves. There's a hell of a lot of work that's still needed to back up what's in these recommendations.
Yeah, I think for me, Cian, the most interesting part was the fact that they needed to put down in paper that they were going to guarantee the most basic things for the women's teams. And I think we've all probably, over the last number of years, heard the anecdotal evidence about the lack of preparation that was going into the team. And I don't mean like video analysis or nutrition or training. I mean things like football boots. You know, I remember going to an interview a player, and she was a little bit late on the eve of a World Cup because she was running over to the Nike shop to buy herself a pair of boots in the discount shop. And I knew another player had been wearing a pair of secondhand boots that she bought on eBay, because these were amateur players who were trying to make ends meet in their lives and going out to represent their country. And so many people were they almost didn't believe that was the reality. But I think the fact that these things have to be put down on paper and guaranteed now for these women in the future just shows the low bar that was set for these women. And I think now as well that the way the IRFU are approaching it, and they're you know, it's kind of almost like they're conciliatory because of the situation that they know themselves that they put these women in, is probably the best place to start. Like, they have to start at the absolute ground now and try and build it up, and you hope that they will do that.
Yeah, exactly. You're spot on, Marie. Like, you think back to the Irish women's footballers, the standard they took a few years ago, and you look now at the benefits of that. I mean, the whole landscape has changed around Irish women's football, and it's like really exciting, and there's a proper buzz around the team. Like, that's not the case, unfortunately, for the rugby team at the moment. And it will take, like I said, it's going to take a few years to get that back on track. But I think what's important in all of this, and for exactly the reasons that you said, is that we particularly highlight the work that Cliona Maloney, Keira Griffin, Claire Malloy and Lindsay Pete have done. You know, when no one else was sort of brave enough to take on the IRFU to write this, you know, letter to the government to support Ireland, they stuck their heads above the parapet. And, like, you know, it was for their own good at the time, but I think it's more for what's coming down the line of future generations. That, you know, you had Keira Griffin, the Ireland captain in her late 20s, stepping away. Like, and I know it wasn't solely because Ireland didn't make it to the World Cup. She had her own reasons as well. But, like, even the optics of that were absolutely terrible. Like, you can just never imagine that happening in the men's game or anything like that. So I think these four girls are to be 100% commended for their bravery, for want of a better term, for standing up for what is right. And that's what ultimately this boils down to. Because, like you said, The women are not looking for anything mad here. Like, it's just looking for basic requirements. And you would hope, like I said, that future generations will reap the benefits of this. I thought it was telling that Keira Griffin, on behalf of the player group, released the statement earlier, and that they were pretty accepting of what was contained within the report and the recommendations. So, like, those four girls are, but apart from Cliona Maloney, who obviously we might get onto that, isn't included in the Six Nations squad, but the other three girls are essentially out of the system now because they've retired. So it'd probably be unfair to say they don't have skin in the game, because of course they do. But if they weren't happy, I think, with what was in it, I don't see them signing a letter and, you know, signing off in it. So you would hope that it is a change. You know, they single out Kevin Potts is the new IRFU CEO, and apparently since he's come in, you know, he's been super positive and super helpful behind the scenes. So the IRFU have made positive steps, but I think the key word in that is steps. There's still a lot more that needs to be done.
Yeah, and there's so many comparisons between this reviewed today and the report, and when you look at what happened with the women's soccer team back in 2017, because what they were looking for were very basic things like access to training facilities, like access to the gym, you know, just simple things that you would think is, you know, Wi-Fi in their hotels when they went away, things that you would think that they would be getting as automatic, and they weren't. So hopefully when you look at how the women's soccer team have progressed, just in terms of what's happening off the pitch for them with sponsorships and recognition and being looked after, and, you know, girls coming through the domestic league, that something similar will happen for women's rugby, and that it will be a turning point. It is is, however, a little bit concerning when you don't see Cliona Maloney in the squad. And although Potts said that it wasn't related, it's, you'd have to just wonder a little bit.
Yeah, they say anything you would, but in saying that as well, I would highly doubt that a new head coach, like a really respectable guy like Greg McWilliams, came into the system and was told, like, you know, that his hands were tied in terms of selection. That would just be getting a new era off on a bad foot. So look, we'll have to take them at face value first. The optics aren't great, you're right. I mean, she was the one kind of current player who was quite aggressive in what she said was slurry spreading when Anthony Eddie made his controversial remarks last November, I think it was. So, look, that's one, I think, for Greg McWilliams, the new head coach, to address. We haven't actually spoken to him yet. He hasn't done any media. So, no doubt, when he's up in the next few weeks, that will be one of the first things that puts him. Because Cliona Maloney is one of, now that we've had so many retirements from the team, like, she's one of the most experienced players, and she's also playing at a very high level in the Women's Premiership in England. So it's a strange one to get your head around, but it'll be interesting to hear what Greg McWilliams' explanation for it is.
Yeah, for sure. We will, well, you will no doubt be asking him when you see him. Okay, Cian, look, I think on overall pretty good news. Just in terms of the not reporting it or not publishing the full findings, is that finite now done, or do you think there will be any calls for that?
No, I don't think there will. And I think, interestingly, you know, there's a second review that's also going on at the moment into the overall kind of women's structures. I think that relates to kind of the AIL schools, you know, which there is a lot of good work being done. I mean, you look at the AIL finals last week in Donnybrook at Energia Park. Like, some of the rugby that was played was incredible, and you could see the crowd there as well. So it just shows you what can be achieved. But the word coming out of today, the press conference today, was that even that second review into the overall game, that the findings won't be made public either. It'll be recommendations as well, which is the likely road we're going down on. So I think, like I said at the start, that it would just open a can of worms, I think, for the IRFU in terms of the men's game and wanting to see reports into potentially future World Cup failures.
Yeah, and look, as you said, you know, there are so many positive things going on as well. And we might as well finish on a positive note. I was talking to a little girl there the other day, and she is 12, and her rugby club, St. Mary's, are planning a trip for the girls to go to Biarritz. And I think if you had told me 4 or 5 years ago that a young girl's rugby team would be heading over on a trip to Biarritz to play some rugby, I wouldn't have believed you. So there is definitely really good things going on. Cian Tracy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marie. Chat to you later.
Talk to you soon.
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Now, welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. Alan Cawley is with me in studio. It is 34 minutes past 6. Almost 7 o'clock, Alan. We better get through this football. A big weekend in the Premier League. Fergal Brennan is also with us. Fergal, I'm going to start with you, actually, because there has been a little bit of movement on the Chelsea story. So it seems that a Turkish billionaire, Muhsin Barak, is the latest party to launch a bid to buy Chelsea from Roman Abramovich. He is, of course, a billionaire, so he does have the cash. But is this a realistic bid, do you think?
I think we're going to see a bit of speculation surrounding the Chelsea situation probably for the next couple of weeks or so. Richard Masters, the Premier League chief executive, was interviewed about this yesterday at a summit in London, where he had quite a few questions to answer about current issues going on in Premier League football. And he referred back to the fastest ever sale in the Premier League, which took 10 days. But he said, generally speaking, these things do take about 3 to 4 weeks, particularly because of the sums of money involved. And now, because the fit and proper persons test and the owners and directors test is hopefully a bit more stringent, I would say this is viable. I would say anybody that's in a position to invest the types of sums that are being talked about. But I keep going back to the Newcastle example. People keep referring to that of how that was done. This is a completely different situation. The amount that, even if Abramovich was to take a significant hit on Chelsea, the amount that's being asked for is in and around 8 or 9 times more than Newcastle was bought for. So I don't think it'll be a fast-track thing. I would be personally quite surprised if it's done done and dusted before the end of the season. I think we might see it in the last couple of weeks of the campaign. But it's a big amount of money being thrown around. Any bid, any potential interest. So anything that comes through that is viable, I would take seriously. But in terms of it being done quickly, I don't think so.
Yeah, I suppose there are going to be an awful lot of different people now linked to Chelsea over the next while. Conor McGregor was linked yesterday, but that seems to have gone very, very quiet. They do play Burnley at the weekend, Alan, and just in terms of, from a player point of view, we've obviously heard Tuchel saying like he's really happy there and he hopes that everything is okay. But given like the timing of the different announcements, so the announcement about Chelsea potentially going to the Charitable Trust was just before the League Cup final, and then during the week then the announcement of the sale was just before their FA Cup game. So there must be a huge amount of uncertainty for the players at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure there is, Marie, but the fact that they're under contract, I'm sure they'll just concentrate on the job in hand in terms of what's on the pitch. Of course, there's a lot of uncertainty with what's going on off it, but I don't think that really will affect them too much, to be honest with you, Marie. I know when things like that and who's going to take over, like, these are seriously wealthy players anyway, so it's not like they're worrying about will there be food on the table tomorrow. Like, let's be honest,
it's more the distraction though, because it's a huge distraction, Alan, and like, in fairness, like, they haven't been hugely consistent for the whole season, so it could take only a small thing to derail them again when they had those up and down spells. And like, I know it's Burnley, but I mean, what happens if they go on a losing run then, like, you know?
Yeah, well, I watched them against Luton the other night and they made heavy weather of that. Obviously, yeah. Luton made a great fight of it, really, and it was only a late goal, the winning goal that they got Chelsea. And they have, I agree with you, they have been hit and miss and very inconsistent. I think there's a lot of contributing factors to that we discussed over the course of the season with injuries and COVID and what have you, especially around Christmas time. But there's still a serious squad, Marie. Like, they've a serious squad of players, brilliant manager. It wouldn't surprise me even if they go far now in the Champions League, because in cup competitions, I still think they're capable of beating anyone on their day. I think there's a major problem with Lukaku. You look at him again the other night, it's just not happening for him at Chelsea. And it's not happening, I don't think, for the players around him as well. I don't think they're comfortable in having him in the team as well. It changes their game a little bit. So there may be problems around that, but I don't think the off-the-field stuff will be much of a distraction for those players. I really don't. Like, whoever takes over Chelsea, like, it's, you're talking about another billionaire taking them over. I suppose the one concern what people were suggesting was when Abramovich came in, he changed the face of it in terms of the money that they were able to, obviously the quality of player that they were able to bring in. Will that change now with him gone? I don't think so if there's another billionaire taking over.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on who does take over in the end. And look, maybe he will get someone that isn't as big a billionaire as he was and might not have the funds, because he is trying to get a bit of a quick sale, although he says he isn't. I mean, he clearly needs to offload it as quick as possible. So who knows what he is going to settle for. Anyway, Fergal, let's get back to the action. We do have a Manchester derby this weekend, and quite an intriguing one as well.
Yeah, there's a huge amount riding on both managers, both sets of players ahead of this one. And we've seen, obviously, over the last 10 years, again, going back to this idea of clubs being bought out and changing perceptions over them. Manchester City have obviously overtaken United in terms of recent Premier League title wins. United, obviously, ahead in the overall race with the amount of Premier League titles that they've won. But in the position that both Rangnick and Pep Guardiola are in this weekend, Ralf Rangnick knows that Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham are still breathing down United's neck to get a top four place. And Pep Guardiola and Manchester City know that they can't really miss a step, because Liverpool are right on their tail. I honestly think this could be one of the best Manchester derbies we've seen for a couple of years. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, obviously his overall record at Manchester United wasn't great. That eventually cost him his job, but his record against City was actually relatively good. This is going to be a big test for Rangnick to see whether he can replicate that aspect of what Solskjaer did manage to get right during his time in charge at United. Because if they do, they give themselves a little bit of an advantage in the top four race, and it ironically actually swings it for Liverpool. So there's a lot of probably bittersweet going around the minds of the fans involved in this. Manchester United fans not wanting to do Liverpool a favour, City fans likewise, etc. But there's a lot on the line for both of them here, because if United drop points, Arsenal have, I think, 3 games at hand on them. That could see them take advantage of the top four position. If City drop points and Liverpool beat West Ham, who were playing the night before, then they are suddenly in the box seat to take over and lead the Premier League going into the running.
Alan, would you agree? Does it have the potential to be one of the great derbies?
Possibly. It just depends on what Man United show up. Man City, we all know what Man City will show up. It just depends in terms of Man United, because their performances are so hit and miss, particularly the performances. That's the worst part. They have been picking up results, but you look at the last 8 games, Marie, league games, they've drawn 4 and they've won 4, but as I say, the performances are so suspect in each game as well. You just don't know what you're going to get out of them. There's all the noise coming from the camp as well. Every day of the week there's a different story about one player not happy, or they're not happy with Ragnick management. So there's a lot of, you're talking about uncertainty around Chelsea. That's the kind of uncertainty that would worry me, what's coming out of the Man United camp. And you look at it, I suppose, the game on Sunday, Marie, I would fancy Man City. I don't fancy Man United against anybody. I don't care who's in charge. I don't fancy them against anybody, and especially not Man City. And you look at the games that they've played in the last 8 or 9 that I'm speaking about, or since Ragnick has taken over. The only one that was being in the top 6 was West Ham, and funny enough they actually won that, and it wasn't a bad performance, but they haven't played any of the top teams since he's come in, so this is a serious test. The only top team you could suggest that they've played since he's come in was the Champions League game against Atletico Madrid, and they're not even hitting the heights that they've hit in recent seasons, and they were struggling so badly that night. So I wouldn't fancy Man United at all.
It could be a big enough weekend, really, in the title chase when you think about it, because Liverpool are up against West Ham, and West Ham are a team as well that could trouble them, Fergal.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, again, there's a similar parallel with the Manchester derby in Liverpool against West Ham. You've got a team pushing for the title and a team pushing for the top 4. My gut is that West Ham will probably slip away. I think their squad is a bit too thin. They didn't get a chance to strengthen in January. And I think as the season starts to get into the last half a dozen games or so, I think the top 4 race will change and they'll probably just slip out of it. But I think, looking ahead to this weekend, Liverpool are probably the one with the clearest task at hand. If they win against West Ham, which, despite the fact that, as I say, West Ham are pushing for top 4, Liverpool would expect to win at home. If Man City don't get a win, even though they are at home to Manchester United, it's a derby, form goes out of the window, all the old clichés. Liverpool then go back to having this game in hand, and suddenly we could see a change. And we haven't seen a change at the top for months. And when you get into the end of the season, so much of it becomes about mentality, the psychology of the managers, the players, the fans, the momentum behind them. These little results can make a big sea change. I've been saying it for some time that the game at the Etihad in April between Liverpool and Man City might not be the one that decides the title. I don't necessarily think it will be. I think it's been built up in that way. I think a very random game for either one of them to either drop points or push on will decide who wins the title race. And that could be it this weekend. I agree slightly with what Alan is saying, that you don't really know what you're going to get with United. If United can turn in a positive performance and get something from City, then suddenly we have a situation where Liverpool are the favourites, whereas it's been Manchester City leading the way for months.
Okay, Fergal, thank you so much. Hopefully it'll be a good weekend for Liverpool fans, but we will find out in a few days' time. Thank you, Fergal. Right, Alan, it is a busy weekend in the League of Ireland, as it is all the time now, because the League of Ireland is back on. So let us check in with Tony O'Donoghue, who is at Pats versus Rovers for us, and John Kenny, who's covering Shells and Derry.
Game on.
Football.
It's the meeting of the league champions and the FAI Cup holders, though much has changed here at Richmond Park since November. Manager Stephen O'Donnell left in acrimonious circumstances, bringing Mountney, Bone and Benson with him to Oriel Park, and they weren't the only departures. New boss Tim Clancy, who arrived from Drogheda, had a big rebuilding job on his hands, and it looked like he'd hit the ground running with an opening night 3-0 win over Shelburne. However, since then, the Saints have lost at home to Sligo and away to Bowes, and they'll hardly face a tougher test than the visit of the champions. They'll be without defender Paddy Barrett, but otherwise have a full squad to choose from. Expect James Abankwa, Billy King and Darry Burns to return and strengthen the side. Pats outplayed Rovers in the pre-season's President's Cup final, but the Hoops took the trophy on penalties, and so the champions are favourites again this evening, having already recorded 2 wins and 1 defeat in this campaign so far. Stephen Bradley is without Sean Kavanagh and Neil Ferrugia, but with Jack Byrne showing on Monday against Drogheda that he was back to his best, it's a question of who to leave on the bench for the Rovers boss. It's another sold-out game and a tasty Dublin derby. It's Pats against Rovers. Kick-off at Inchicore is at 7:45.
Game on.
Football.
Shells have started life back in the top flight with a loss, a win and a draw facing a Derry City side tonight that some have tipped to make a title run this year. One swallow does not make a summer, but Derry will have been buoyed by the late win over the champion Shamrock Rovers last Friday. Although they could only manage a 0-0 draw against Sligo on Monday, a bit of a come down that one from beating the Hoops so late. Derry did suffer, though, a big injury blow when they lost their excellent and influential midfielder Kieran Harkin, who suffered an ACL rupture last Friday, and manager Rory Higgins now forced into a bit of a reshuffle. This will be a big test, though, for Shells tonight, facing a side that perhaps are one of the fittest in the league, and a Joe McGonigal, their striker, a real goal threat. Kick-off at Talca Park is at 7:45.
Game on.
Football.
Alan Colley, you are heading to Pats and Rovers.
I'm looking forward to it, Marie, yeah. As you say, the league back, so Friday night, if anybody's looking for me, I'll be in the League of Ireland ground, as people know. So I'm heading over, yeah. Should be a good game. Obviously, they're coming thick and fast for Shamrock Rovers because their rivals, who we were all suggesting will be their rivals for the season, was Derry last week. So they obviously went up to the Brandywell, they got beat. And here they are tonight going to Inchicore against St. Pat's. Tough game for them as well. So, and Pats need to bounce back. They've lost their last two against Sligo and Bohemians on Monday night.
Okay, well, enjoy that, Alan. Do stay with me, though. We're going to take a very quick break, and then it is Hurling and Jane Mangan.
RTE
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM. With Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Now, welcome back to the show. It is time to talk hurling because hurling is taking centre stage this weekend. Shane McGrath is with me now on the line. Shane, when I was looking through the fixtures, there's a huge amount of ones that I want to talk about for very different reasons. For you, what's the standout one? I'm curious. Like, what for you is the most important game this weekend?
I suppose for me, Marie, I suppose it's probably Waterford and Tip for a few reasons. in that Tip boys are going down to Waterford. Liam Cahill's first match against Tip since he kind of refused, I suppose, maybe, the big job in Tip, and has stuck with the Waterford boys and shown faith to them. And it's a big dress rehearsal for the Munster Championship down there on, I think it's the 17th of April. So I think there's a lot of things, you know, with Walsh Park. It's you know, the crowd are in atop you. I think there'll be a right crowd at it. So I think for me, for all those reasons, with Liam Cahill going against Tip and Colin Bonner trying to make a statement with his, you know, his new style of play that he's supposedly trying to bring into the group, I think that's a very interesting one down there on Sunday in Waterford. Like,
yeah, I'm kind of sick now of analysing Limerick's problems and lauding how great Cork are, so it is nice to talk about a few different counties. And obviously for me then, Clare is one that I wanted to talk about. And like, hosting Limerick in Cusick Park, it is the game where Limerick are coming in on the back of not showing much form. So it does feel like it's a really important one for Clare to kind of to go at them and to get that win, I suppose, almost just to get that one over Limerick.
Yeah, it is, like, and again, this is kind of another, you know, looking forward to Munster Championship, May the 15th, it'll be the same fixture again, Clare and Limerick down in Cusick Park. I think Clare are, I think they're coming into it in a nice place, Marie. I think Tony Kelly's back, Aaron Shanahan, you know, came on, did well against Offaly. Peter Duggan is getting back. So I think, you know, Brian Lohan, every week that he sits down to pick the team, it's getting harder and harder to pick it. And I think it's a great way to be with the league, like, you know. I mean, you know, they've scored 420 against Offaly. Shane Meehan's another guy that's really, really showing well for you. And, you know, he scored 1-1 the last day. And, like, it's crazy, isn't it, that Tony Kelly has played one game and already he's in the top 10 scorers in the National Hurling League. So there's a guy coming into it in a great vein of form. So I think Clare are going to really go for this. Like, I mean, looking statistically or mathematically, really, I don't know. I don't think will they have much of a chance of qualifying for a semi-final, because if it goes to a head-to-head against either Cork or Wexford, you know, who are top of the table at the moment, Marie, They've lost those games already. So if there's three teams tied in, it's a score difference. But even at that, Clare are going to be a bit behind, you know, even with a game or two to go. So I think Clare will really go for it. For Limerick, as you said, I think everyone is sick about talking about that they haven't won a game. I was at the match. I was doing on duty. They were Martin Kiley last week, and I just don't think, they just don't look that much interested in the league at the moment, in my opinion. But at the other side of it is, you can't just switch it on. I'm sure Alan will agree there. Same in the football as hurling. You can't just switch on, you know, morale or confidence in the group. It can't just happen all of a sudden. I think they will need a win, and I think John Kiley will go as strong as he possibly can to try and get a win just for the group. for before, you know, because their league is done now after their next game, so they'll want to be they'll want to get a win. And I suppose worrying for them that I think Sean Finch suffered a concussion from the Cork game, Marie, so he's going to be a loss. He's probably going to be out for a little while. So I think John Kiely will pick a very strong team, but I think Clare are in a good place, and I think they might sneak the victory there at the weekend.
Yeah, well, you're throwing out dates there for championship, and like, April is next month, you know what I mean? Like, it's crazy that it's just coming around so much. And even listening to Brian Cody speaking, and you know, he's talking about making sure that he's got his settled squad for a championship, because it's just coming around, it's just around the corner. So they're playing, Kilkenny are playing Dublin, and like, from just the purely neutral point of view, living up in Dublin now, like, Dublin have been impressive so far this season.
Oh, really have, and I'm on duty there at Pádraic Lodge tomorrow night. I really look forward to it. Parnell on a Saturday night is always a good buzz around the place. And like, Dublin are going really well, but I suppose, Marie, like, Matty Kenny has had the advantage, I suppose, of being able to pick, I suppose, his strongest team. And I think he's dead right to do it, because you can't beat momentum. You know, this is his fourth year in charge as well, Marie, so he's going to want to win a trophy. He really, really is. You know, people are saying to me, you know, Dublin are hard to beat in Parnell. Like, to be honest, if there's one team that don't mind coming to Parnell and playing Dublin, it's Kilkenny. Last year in the league, they bet them there by 5 points. You go back to 2017, they bet them there by 7 points. Like, you have to go back to 2015, the last time Dublin bet Kilkenny in the league. And, you know, their top scorer from play that day was Danny Sutcliffe, 4 points. And there you go, seven seasons on. He's probably their best player so far in the league again. So I think Dublin are in a great vein of form. I don't think Kilkenny are. I think, you know, he didn't have a very strong team out against Laois, had a very good win. But I just don't think it's the same force. Kilkenny aren't the same force as what they used to be. And I think Dublin, with the momentum, with Matty Kenny being able to pick everyone as strong as he can, they're hurling well, they're moving well, and I just think they'll be in a good place, and I think they'll enjoy the big crowd there tomorrow night. I think it's on telly as well. So I think that the Dubs, with the likes of O'Donnell, Crummy, Donald Burke, Sutcliffe, Ronan Hayes, Rean McBride, all these guys in form, I think that they'll get the victory there tomorrow night. But should be a good game, Marie.
Cork and Galway is on telly as well, RTE 2 at 7 o'clock. Cork obviously have been quite impressive themselves. Galway will have been disappointed though, as Henry Shefflin will no doubt know. Coming up against this Cork team, it would probably be a good one to get the win in it, Shane.
It will, go down to Páirc Uí Chaoimh, I suppose, and Cork love playing down to Páirc Uí Chaoimh, score 230 against your own boys there already, Marie. But I think Cork, it was gas the last day, like, everyone coming out are talking about the Cork Limerick game. No one's talking about the hurling or the score. Everyone's talking about all the rows that were going on, and, you know, lads baiting the heads off each other, you know, lads rolling around the ground and everything. Cork had a message. They really had a message sent out to Limerick that what you did to us in the All-Ireland final last year, that's not going to happen again. And again, Cork are coming in great Vienna form, and I have to say, Marie, I think they have a new set of leaders now. They're gone away maybe from Harnady and Horgan and depending on them all the time. I think the likes of Lehan is back in a great Vienna form. Dara Fitzgibbon, Mark Coleman and Shane Kingston, I think they're the new leaders of Cork, and I think Cork people are looking to them now to drive this thing on. And I do think Henry Shefflin is still trying to find his best team. I think he, even from the Limerick game, he had a lot of changes against Wexford the last day. Disappointing that they lost in Salt Hill, because, you know, they usually play fairly well there. But I think he's looking for his settled team all the time. You know, scored 27 points against Limerick, only scored 15 points against Wexford. So that'll tell you know, that there was a change in personnel. So I think, you know, that it won't be the end of the world if they don't win this. They're sitting third at the moment on 4 points. I mean, Cork and Wexford are looking like the front runners to qualify for the league semi-final. And I just think with Cork's pace and Galway defensively are not the fastest, Cork are going to look to get goals. They look to get goals against Limerick the last day. They got them, and I think they look to get them again this tomorrow night, Marie. And I just think Cork are playing with great confidence at the moment, and that they should win that game down at Páirc Uí Chaoimh tomorrow night.
Okay, Shane McGrath, thank you so much, and so much to look forward to there over the weekend from a hurling point of view. Now, a little bit earlier, I caught up with Jane Mangan to talk racing as we edge closer to Cheltenham.
Game on.
Racing.
Jane, domestic racing at Leopardstown and Wexford this Sunday, but perhaps it's tomorrow's card at Navan which features the most intriguing race.
Yeah, that Flying Bolt Navan Chase tomorrow. I suppose this time, so close to Cheltenham, we probably don't have the quality that you'd want, because, of course, the real good horses have been put away for Prestbury Park in little over 10 days' time. But the Flying Bolt Navan Chase is a great treat. It's over 2 miles. A lot of it is about pace. There's only 6 declared horses in here, and I think Willie Mullins has found it a nice opportunity for Gentleman Demy. Gentleman Demy went to Cheltenham last year. He was a selection by many for the Martin Pipe, who, you know, ironically, Willie Mullins ended up winning that race anyway with a horse called Galloping Deschamps. Didn't he turn out to be okay? But I think the occasion at Cheltenham got to Gentleman Demy too much. He was too keen and he kind of pulled his chance away. But he's looked like a good chaser. He was very good at Turles. He's a horse that goes forward. He's very, he can be keen, but Mark Walsh knows the key to this guy. He'll go forward, and I'd imagine at Navan, he'll take quite a bit of catching tomorrow.
And what about Cross Channel? It is a big day for the Scottish track. Kelso hosts their feature card tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm actually queuing in a terminal to get to Kelso for tomorrow. It's their biggest day, and the Moor Battle Hurdle was won by the Shunter last year. Emmett Mullins and Paul Byrne made a plan last year to try and seize a 100 grand double. The 100 grand double was to win the Moor Battle Hurdle and any race at the Cheltenham Festival. He did that with the Shunter when he went on to win the Paddy Power Plate under Jordan Gainford at Cheltenham. And there's 6 horses in the Moor Battle this year that will be, that are entered at Cheltenham. So if they win tomorrow, they will be in line for that lucrative double. But realistically, the star of the show is Bouvardair, dual champion hurdle winner. He is in there for Nicky Henderson, his first run since Aintree last April. And I think Metier is an interesting horse as well. He won at Tolworth last year. He's a horse that has a county hurdle entry and a Coral Cup entry. So if he were to win, wouldn't it be surprising if anybody saw him line up in Prestbury Park for Harry Fry.
It's hard to believe it's only 11 days until the Tuesday of Cheltenham. I don't know where that year went. It absolutely flew by. But these kind of final few days, the run-in, they do throw up a few curveballs, don't they?
Yeah, I think it's a really nervous time for owners in particular. Owners don't want to see their trainers' numbers appear on the phone because inevitably or invariably, you're going to think it's going to be bad news. We saw that with Allegory Devassi during the week. She was a short price for the mayor's novice for William Mullins, Rich Ritchie. She fell by the wayside with a hock injury. There was a